Huh? You are listening to station WGN.
Oh, a microphone!
And a phony at the mic! Whoa!
And radio became an accepted vehicle for nationwide news and opinion.
Notify all radio and TV stations to broadcast the following message.
Oh, is that the comedy spot?
No, Bubblehead, this isn't a comedy spot.
You're a fun guy, Dave. You're lonely on an island.
What a dope. What a maroon.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is exciting, isn't it?
In 5, 4, 3, 2...
WGN WGN and a pleasant Sunday morning to everyone out there. John Hanson and the amazing Double T Pongo. Double T, how are you doing here this morning?
I'm good this morning. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. It's a hot, hot weekend. It is something else out there.
I've stayed in air conditioning all day.
Right.
And I feel like I haven't given myself a chance to
experience it.
To really experience it.
Good call. Don't do it.
I took the punk's way out, man.
Yeah. Hey. You know, I went to the Cubs game yesterday in the bleachers at a 405, so the hottest point of the day yesterday, and I roasted. You know, and I thought, yeah, I've been to Cubs games, I'm in Chicago, I don't know what hot
I can take minutes. This.
It was miserable. There's
really?
A bar. It's a little unknown secret for many people that go to Cubs games in the bleachers. There's actually a bar underneath the scoreboard, and it's a great place to cool off. The breeze comes through, and on most normal summer afternoons, the bar, you know, it's busy. It does some business up there. They take credit card up there, so that's perfect for me. I never have any cash. And I'm still got to buy those drinks. And even that was packed up there because it's cool up there. And that's when I knew that it was really hot. But I had to go up there for a little bit, go down. People were passing out in the bleachers, and hopefully everyone's okay. But, man, it is insane. So, anyways, I went out afterwards and went and grabbed a burrito from Chipotle, only 3 or 4 blocks from my place. I came back. I mean, we're only talking about a half mile walking. I came back drenched. And I wonder, like, there are people in the city, I know there are,
right,
that don't have air conditioning. How do you people do it?
I don't know how they do it.
I mean, and a lot of them, it's not good. We're talking about some serious stuff, obviously, but 312-91-7200. I either want to hear what you got either on the phones or the text line. How do you do it? How do you stay cool and how do you stay
survive?
Safe? Or are you that person out there? I'm sure there's someone out there that has air conditioning but says, nah, still not hot enough. I got to save a couple dollars. I ain't gonna
that used to be me.
Really?
That used to be me. I was that person. I was waiting until the heat index hit 100,000
Yeah, you're
degrees.
Like, I ain't turning this on,
and
right?
Then but this morning I had a feeling it was going to be serious. Turn my AC on before I left the house when I came back. Mm-hmm. House is nice and cool. I need to turn it off, save the rest of the energy, put it on autosave remote. That's the best way to go. You don't want to play games with this type of weather, man, especially if you drink caffeine, you drink a lot of coffee, you'll feel exhausted. A lot of things we drink that we think are hydrating us dehydrate us, from soda pop to coffee. You got to be serious about these things.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you are energy conscious and you cool down the house too much during the day. I do. I put it at 74 and go. I'm gone for 4 hours. I don't care. I want
it at
74.
That's not the green thing to do.
Don't care. I want that thing as cold. I want it an ice box the moment I walk into that place. Normally, I don't. No, I got the thermostat. I don't have a Nest, but I got those thermostat settings that'll up and down. I overrode all of that. I just said 74. Cold. I know I'm contributing to the power problem. I understand it.
For shame.
I know, but I wanted it cool just for today and yesterday. But yeah, it was it's something out there. So I know there's some people out there that still haven't turned on their air conditioning or getting by. And I'd love to hear from them. 312-981-7200. Do anything fun so far this weekend, Domati? Get out and about?
Yeah, you know, actually, last weekend, I'm so glad, Mambi on the Beach. I don't know if you've heard this festival. Yep. Mambi on the Beach. I meant to talk about this the last time I saw you. Wonderful festival, and actually had a chance to see Common perform live. Rapper Common was on the show Underground or WGN.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad it was not that hot that weekend.
Yeah,
hot that weekend. Right. Oh my God! But that's been the most interesting thing I've done all day. I was smart enough to stay in the house.
Yeah.
Finally watched the documentary about Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre.
Mm. How was it?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Four-series documentary. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Iovine is a visionary and responsible for most of the music we listen to. I did not know.
Yeah, and it's always so fascinating when you hear the behind-the-scenes of the behind-the-scenes of how much that certain people, that individuals that you think you know a lot about, you don't know anything about. So.
That's why I'm so excited for the segment you got coming up later on.
Yeah.
We're talking about the movies that you have to see this summer.
Yeah, exactly. And Blake Stubbs, hopefully, will be joining us in just a little bit. 312-91-7200. That's not for Blake. That's for anyone to jump in. Because there are some quintessential movies, not only this summer, but like like, there's got to be movies out there that everyone has, like, that makes them feel like it's summer. Or on a hot right. summer day, they're like, I'm going to pop that on. I'm going to reach into the closet, find that on the old DVD or on the VHS and pop that in. Or it just makes you feel like it is summer. Today, I got to give a shout-out to Pino's Palette, which is a painting class thing. I got to do that a little bit today.
Yeah,
went on a little date. Yeah, 2 hours, a little drinking while you do it. They have the final draft of what you're supposed to do, and you have an artist who teaches you and walks you through how to paint. And it's pretty amazing what you can do in 2 hours with some acrylic paint. It was pretty cool stuff.
Where can people see what you painted?
Oh man, go to my Instagram, John Hanson TV.
John is not bad. I find out you cheated, though. Little do you guys know, John has some artist blood in his bloodline.
Yeah, my grandfather was a watercolor painter, Ken Bean, and a pretty famous one at that in the watercolor painting circles. And
they have circles.
Right, exactly. His daughter, my mom, carried on that, and she's a great painter as well, and also an art teacher. So I did have some cheating going on. So that's how I stayed cool, stayed indoors. Curtis Coca-Cola, Curtis Coke, how you doing, man?
Good, nice to see you again, John.
You too. How did would you keep cool this weekend? What are you doing?
Actually, I've been working a lot.
I've
been here since 6. I was doing the Sox game beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
But keeping busy, looking forward to another fun-filled week. I'll be actually here 4th of July. Plyer and I will be filling in for Cochran.
Oh, in the morning.
Yes, in the morning. And then I will also be producing Bill and Mundy Tuesday. And literally, I'm here the whole week of 4th of July. So I'm going to be around producing a lot.
Well, the air conditioning is like the only thing that is working here, so that's the good news, is that everything is fine.
No, I got working a little too well, actually. It's freezing.
It's cold. I know. I feel like I can't say that on the air, because there's someone listening that's dying in the heat.
Right.
That's listening. They're listening right now because they're like, oh, I just can't sleep in this heat, and we're like, oh, man, it's too cold in here. So 312-981-7200, we'd love for you to join the conversation any way that you want to. Before we get to this break, I want to tease this ahead, and before we get to Blake Stubbs and the rest of the show, I love starting the show with like a little quiz that's in the news. So, Curtis, Domati, ears up. Here we go.
Okay.
A biological mother and a daughter, their age is 100 and they are ages 79, so they're 21 years apart. They did something recently, in the past couple days, that they had never done before in their lives together. So, you know, mothers, daughters, they've been around a long time. It's a miraculous story, and they did it for the first time on Sunday. They did it in South Florida. And I don't know how many more clues I can give away. There was encouragement from both the mother's friends and family and, of course, the daughter. And they did something they had never done before, which is pretty incredible stuff. The mother of 100 has a little bit of dementia, which made this a little bit more difficult. But it was something that they had done together that they had never done before. 312-981-7200 if you want to text in and guess. Curtis, do we have any prizes? I don't think we have any prizes, but we can give Curtis a leave like your the answering machine on your voicemail or something like that. I always like that.
Yeah, we could do something.
We'll, we'll give you pride.
That's
we'll
a
give
good
you
prize.
Something. But they did something I wish I could give away more clues without giving away exactly what it is.
Gotta give us more.
I know. I'm trying to figure out. Tell
I had about. Something in my mind. When you said dementia, that narrowed some things down.
Mm-hmm. First time they've ever done this together. So we're going to continue on the show here. We're going to have Blake Stubbs here in a little bit. We're going to figure out what this mother-daughter pair did for the first time. And plenty more coming up on 720 WGN. For a second, I thought that was something was wrong with the studio.
I almost started rapping the lyrics on there, but I couldn't remember if it was FCC approved or not.
Right, yeah, exactly. Hey, 312-981-7200, John Hanson, Doma T. Pongo filling in for Dave Plyer on this Sunday morning. Okay. So I'm going to give you a few more clues here, Domati.
Help me out.
A 100-year-old woman, a mom, and her daughter, a 79-year-old woman, did something for the very first time. You know, and you go through life, you imagine that most people have done everything together. We've got a few guests. So they did something for the first time ever in their history as mother and daughter.
And a few clues. They're from South Florida.
Yeah, they did it in South Florida. And I don't know what else if I gave another clue.
The mother has dementia.
The mother has dementia.
Which made this more difficult.
Which made it more difficult. Let's go to Glenn. Glenn, you're on 720 WGN. What do you think that this mother and daughter pair did? Glenn, can you hear me? Did I mess
you know
it
what?
Up?
We're still having some issues with the phone.
Oh, okay.
So
Glenn's guess was?
Guess was climbing a mountain.
Climbing a mountain? No, it is not.
Not climbing a mountain.
Not climbing a mountain.
Well, let's go to the text line.
Yeah.
So 773 says skydive.
No, was not skydiving.
It was not skydiving.
It was nothing adventurous.
Nothing.
I mean, you're 100 years old. I mean, I know George H.W. Bush, former president, has done some skydiving at 90. Wasn't mountain climbing. Wasn't South Florida. They didn't, like, wrestle alligators or anything like that. Here's another clue for you. They, the daughter had the idea, and she came up with it after watching a TLC show. And she had this idea back in the 90s. So she actually had this idea festering for about 25 years. That's something her and her mother could do. And wow. It's been festering for 25 years, and they finally took care of it. Curtis, did you read the article that I sent you, or do you know the answer?
I to be honest, I did not read the article.
That's fine. I sent it about 2 minutes before the show started. So
that's all right.
And he didn't want us to read it, actually. He didn't want us to know the answer.
I wanted to kind of... My first guess was one of those... because you said dementia, so I was thinking maybe something like to kind of jerk back some memories.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that came to mind was kind of looking into like Ancestry.com and kind of seeing like, you know, the paths of, you know, that sort of thing.
So they dove in together to find out their history?
Yeah, because that's what my mom and grandma have done for just looking into like their family history.
Well, you're getting close because we actually, this happened through Ancestry. They did do this, but they weren't looking together. So, another text comes in 773 saying found a lost relative.
Mm.
We're getting pretty close.
We're getting close here.
And it's, so they did this together. Again, the daughter had the idea watching a TLC show.
Let me throw a guess out there.
Yeah.
Found the daughter's father.
No, but you are so close that you should just, I think we're all kind of beating around it here. Text from the 870, parasailing, no. We're closer with the ancestry sort of thing, but parasailing would be a great guess for Florida. So they didn't find the father, and they didn't find a long-lost relative. I'll wait if anyone else has the answer. 312-981-7200.
I want to get one more text in because I feel like getting close.
So they spent the day doing this, and they did a few activities along the way. They did some painting to kind of cap this whole thing together. Again, they got the idea from a TV show. They used Ancestry DNA to do this. First time a mother and daughter have done this. And I forgot what the other clue was, but they did it together. Well, the answer is, I think we're just going to go ahead and go with it. Oh, 779 says, went to a reunion. That's from Sandy in Woodstock, Illinois. No, it was a reunion of some kind. You ready for the answer here, Domati?
Yeah, I'm ready for it.
They met for the first time. A mom and a daughter, ages 179. So biological mom and daughter met. They each thought the other one was dead. They reunited after learning that they're both very much alive, and they live within 2 hours of each other in South Florida, which is not where this adoption took place. This is not where the mother gave up her daughter back in 1938. The story is made even more miraculous by the fact that both Joanne and her newly discovered mother, Lillian, are from the New York area, but they found themselves down in Florida. They met for the first time on Sunday last week, and the family has learned that both women were under the impression that the other had died during Joanne's birth. So they told, I believe, I'll have to read on and make sure of this, but the daughter definitely thought, as she knew she was adopted, she found out at some point that she was adopted, and she thought that her mom had died while giving birth. So that's the story that she had been told. But she always had this hunch that her mother was still alive. So they were able to, she watched the daughter watch this TLC show back in the early 90s. I forget the name of the show, but it involved reuniting long-lost relatives, long-lost mothers with daughters. And it was a meeting that was a bit awkward at first because Joanne was unsure if her mother had the ability to kind of understand. I mean, 100 years old.
100 years old.
Does mom understand what she's saying? Does she recognize her? The mother has dementia, which made this a little bit more difficult. So Joanne said that she didn't know if that she recognized her at first, but she gave her mother a hug. And after a little bit of time, she said, "I'm Joanne. Do you know who I am? Do you recognize my picture from any place?"
Wow.
And she said, I was adopted in 1938. After my birth mother, they told me passed away. I didn't know how true it was. So Joanne started to tear up. And when the daughter started crying, that's when the mom reacted as if she knew what was going on. So in addition to her son, Elliot, Joanne had his wife, Shelley, and his other grandson there, and other grandchildren over video and smartphones. So everyone was showing each other this sort of stuff. And just a really fascinating story to go through. I mean, if you're 79 and you know you're adopted, what are the odds that your mom or dad is still alive. It's incredible stuff.
What really fascinates me about this, aside from the miracle of them finding out that they live just 2 hours away from one another, but the way the human mind can attach itself to emotions. You can't recognize your daughter. You don't know who this is. You don't even know. But when you see her cry, something feels familiar about that cry. That human connection always moves me. I'm looking at the pictures. If you look at the website, you got pictures that she drew to help jog a memory about who she was. And there's a picture of them, of the mother, 100 years old with these headphones on. And I can only imagine what music she's playing that's kind of jogging a memory about who her daughter is.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine meeting my mom for the first time thinking, I didn't have one all this time.
All right,
this is a good story. How do you find this stuff?
I don't know. Let's go to, we're going to try and get a caller here. Let's go to James. James, you're on WGN. You had the answer, didn't you, James?
I guess so. I was just trying to guess, and it sounded right. Like, you know, they're 179. I figured they met the first time. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, James, where are you calling from?
Bolingbrook.
Yeah. I know some people that, I think this day and age, it's a lot different than it was probably in the 30s and 40s. I think a lot of people know they're adopted a lot earlier nowadays, and there's no stigma around it like there probably was in the 30s and the 40s. But I just cannot imagine, that reuniting at that age, James. So I'm glad you got the answer. Sorry we didn't get it in before I revealed it, man.
Wait, James, first, how did your mind even go there, though? Because that's not even something I would be on my radar.
You know, long story short is my kids live in St. Louis, and I'm driving back from seeing them do a musical, and I love my children, and I'm thinking, what kind of event would make it really difficult with dementia? And it has to be some kind of knowledge, and I'm thinking, they probably don't know each other. That's all I was thinking.
Wow. Hey, what musical did your kids do?
They were doing Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, tale as old as time, man. Did you tear up watching? When you say kids, did you have multiple kids in the same musical?
Yeah, my daughter was playing one of the narrators, and my son was playing one of the wolves. So it was all kids' show. It was really cool.
That's really cool stuff. Hey, James, thanks for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Have a great evening, guys.
Yeah, that's
too.
Maybe it takes a parent to understand that, Domity, because
that's what it seems
like. It didn't cross to me either. And this daughter says she had a lifetime of not feeling like she fit in, and she watched this TLC show. It's Long Lost Family was the name of the show, and the whole show was created around that. So it was a long journey to try and find her mom, and just to find out that it was 70 miles away. So it's really great that they were able to reunite and do that. I mean, like when you're 100 years old, obviously some dementia. Not every 100-year-old experiences that, but I'm just glad they were able to do it because, you know, imagine they'd wait a year or 2 years and they don't get it done. It's just a really cool story.
Got to seize the moment.
Yeah. All right. We got to take a quick commercial break. Plenty more here on 720 WGN. Quickest break of all time. That one always catches me off guard, Domity.
Yeah, it got me too.
Yeah. Hey, a little bit later, we're going to be talking about the year 1776. Of course, we're coming up on the 4th of July week. We're going to hear the history of the Declaration of Independence. And don't tee up again your guess. This is a fascinating story.
Fascinating story. So Tanisha T. Bell founded this organization called the Ezekiel Taylor Scholarship Fund. And met her several years ago. I had a chance to meet her at the Illinois Service Federal Bank. They had a gala where they awarded this young man a $5,000 check and a young woman another $5,000 check to give them both an opportunity to go to school. What bound the stories of these two people together, but they both were affected by gun violence in Chicago. And so when we talk to Tanisha, we'll find out what inspired her to create this scholarship fund and how has gun violence affected her and moved her into a new space in her life and career. Really
That's fascinating stuff. That's great stuff. Hey, let's say hello to Roger Banish. Roger, are you staying cool over there or what?
Oh, it is so nice in here. I'm telling you.
Roger, I take a look at the cameras here, and it looks like you kind of, you're behind like what I imagine the Star Trek Enterprise would look like. You got 9 screens in front of you. You're loving the new building. You're loving the new desk.
I am. Yeah, I mean, sometimes I just sit back here when no one's listening, and I just say, "Make it happen."
Yeah. I'm glad that that was the end of that sentence because you were going in another direction. I know you're in a corner of the building that not a lot of people get to.
This
I didn't know
is
what
awesome.
You're doing.
You know, back when I was young, before the troubles of the world came upon us,
right.
The stations, the two top stations in town,
okay.
other than WGN, right. were WLS and WCFL, the two rock and roll stations in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to have the DJs in glass enclosed rooms that you could actually go as part of a tour and like stand with your nose up against the glass and watch them do their shows.
Right.
And that's kind of how I feel here, because you really can't see it. I know a lot of people here at the station have posted pictures and videos and stuff, but the newsroom and the master control room are now the two showcase facilities in this station.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's about time you experience what that's like to get the nose up to the glass. We had that for years at the showcase studio.
That's right.
And you got other things up to the glass when you do the 2 to 5 a.m. show. Not just nose and eyes.
Hello,
I've
nurse.
Seen a lot of things up against that glass at these hours. WGN, John Hanson and Domati.
Domati Pongo here.
Yeah, I don't know why I gotta say, keep saying, you just jump in and just you yell at me, Domati. You say your own name.
Of course. It sounds better when you say, you have such a good radio voice. No, I don't know if people tell you that enough.
You got the radio voice in this pairing.
Why, thank you, John.
Actually, we should just have Roger introduce us every single time we come back from break.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, exclusively on WGN Radio, John Hanson and Domati Pongo.
That sounds good when Roger says it.
That's wonderful. That's happening every hour on the hour.
So,
where's the paycheck?
Yeah, right. It's in the mail. When I work on the Dover at WCIU and I do goofy stuff in the street every day, and a lot of times I'm checking, there's like there's a day for everything these days. There's National Blank Day every single day. And usually that can provide me the inspiration for what I'm going to do on the streets with people each day. Trying to think of an example for this week. Friday was National Camera Day. So I had this really cool VW converted Photoshop bus that goes around town. We went around, we took pictures of people. Had him jump in a Photoshop booth.
Had T-Rexes.
Yeah. T-Rex, that was actually to promote Jurassic World, yeah. Whatever the new one is.
I thought T-Rexes were just twerking because that's what T-Rexes do.
Hey, look, I don't need much. Whatever it is, we just get them out there and we figure the rest out as the day goes on. But I never heard of National Asteroid Day, which doesn't seem like a day we want to celebrate all too much, but asteroids are a normally occurring part of our solar system and our interaction with place in the universe.
Absolutely.
But I'm kind of fascinated by how large asteroids must be, and there's this article in Business Insider, how large asteroids must be to destroy cities, state, countries, or the planet. Because, you know, my entire breadth of knowledge about asteroids is from the movies Armageddon and Deep Impact. I mean, that's all I know about asteroids.
That's all you got.
Right. That's all I know.
Yeah, same here. And I was actually listening. I was listening to the story on the way in early this morning, and they were talking about how people look at this like an asteroid hitting the Earth and as something that's so far out the realm of possibilities. But he says we only know what the realm of possibilities are because we're constantly studying up on this.
Right.
And so this article, how far out of the realm of possibilities is this? Are we on par to collide into some space rock?
Space rocks are hitting us all the time. So okay. There's famous meteorites that have happened, and we still have the holes in the ground to prove it. And just look at the moon as your best example to show that things can hit anything. I mean, when you look at the moon, and even from plane's eye, you could see it's rough, it's bumpy, there's holes in it, there's formations. Those are caused by meteors. So if they're slamming against the moon, they're also slamming up here on Earth.
Makes sense.
So there's been ones that we know of. I can't pronounce any of these things. The article says some angry space rocks, like the recent Chelyabinsk meteorite that exploded over Russia. They're big enough to shatter windows or crumble walls. Other than like the I think it's the Tunguska event in 1908 that can flatten an entire city. And handful can trigger global extinctions, like the asteroid that smashed into the Yucatan Peninsula some 66 million years ago. But exactly how big is it? So on the 4th annual World Asteroid Day, so some very, a relatively new day, they took a look at some estimates from NASA. Purdue University apparently has an impact Earth simulator, which seems like somewhere really cool to visit, not too far away in West Lafayette. So the article goes on. Most of us go through life without thinking much about rocks from space, but even a small and relatively frequent asteroid can inflict great damage. By numbers, most meteors are smaller than a car. So if it's smaller than a car, which to me still seems big, it will just burn up into the atmosphere. It'll be harmless. It'll fall to the ground as dust, I guess.
Right.
But when it starts to get bigger than that, things get a little dicey. So meteors that are about as big as a house, let's say, a little smaller than a house, size of a house. I don't know whose house we're talking about, but standard house. Detonate into air bursts above the ground. So the rock itself never actually hits the earth, but it still makes a problem because the sound burst that happens, the shock waves, break windows, which is a scary thought. They very, break windows, yeah.
Very scary.
They can also emit enough light energy to cause sunburn. So meteors that pass through our solar system that are big enough but don't hit the ground can actually give you sunburn.
And does this actually happen, or is this something that can happen? As of now, they're talking about something that can happen based on the science.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm sure that there are examples of that, and they must have some ability to know that. But, yeah, that's a great question. I'll have to dig into this a little
bit more.
Because
I've seen a few people who look like they've got asteroid suntans. It's like, that's not natural.
That's not normal.
That's
right.
It's a space discrepancy there. Yeah.
That's what they can blame it on. There you go.
Right.
A house-sized meteorite can explode in the atmosphere with a force greater than the nuclear weapon. The first one dropped in war on Hiroshima in 1945. So size of a house dropping in the atmosphere can be bigger than Hiroshima. Such a space rock could flatten most buildings within a mile and a half of ground zero. So that's just a rock the size of a house. So from a car to a house, we go from burning up in the atmosphere harmlessly to all the buildings gone within a mile and a half.
What about the size of a state? Now it says here the largest known asteroid, Ceres, is the size of Texas.
Gee, and that's a big one. That ain't Rhode Island.
That at all. It says, lucky for us, Ceres has no chance of striking Earth. And what I found out that's really, because there was also this concern about space junk, not only asteroids, but how many satellites and things we put up in the atmosphere, and eventually when can these things fall down, mm-hmm. and how can that happen? So they say the likelihood, the reason why it's so unlikely that we won't be hit, just because the Earth is mostly water.
Okay.
Likely when these things kind of make their way back down, they're hitting water, and scientists are able to use technology to steer where these things land. But that goes for space junk. That's different than asteroids.
So a London-sized asteroid, they say, so just not even a state, a city, an asteroid the size of London would be more than enough to just get a major extinction. The impact would actually slow down Earth's rotation to make its day last almost half a second longer, which doesn't sound like that much, but you're slowing down the entire rotation of the Earth enough to make the day longer. So would they say extinction? I'm going back to see how long or how big it would be. An asteroid more than a half mile away, half a mile wide. So half a mile wide is where you start to have global implications. It could destroy an area the size of Virginia. It would dust would toss up and block the sun, leading to climate changes across Earth. A crater from a quarter mile asteroid would be more than 100 miles wide. It would kill most of the life on Earth, and that's the same size as the space rock that killed the dinosaur. So that's just to put it in perspective, that all you need for all that is a half mile wide. That doesn't seem too big.
And if we talk about how real this is, 870 puts it in perspective for us, says, don't forget about the meteor crater in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gulf of Mexico was created by a meteor.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I did not know that.
I'll have to dig into that one to make sure that that's 100% accurate there.
Now, I did know about Arizona. Let's see. Gulf of Mexico meteor.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to dig into that one. But if you're talking about how to destroy a city the size of Chicago, which, God forbid, nothing like this would happen, it would be a meteor the size of a football field. This doesn't seem that big. Like, I mean, we got a lot of space rocks moving around. I know that the odds of some of this stuff hitting Earth are not all that big, and they're able to track this stuff out in space for years and years and years ahead of time. But I guess I just expected it would take bigger rocks to destroy the Earth. I mean, a half mile wide.
It's funny how little it takes for things to be thrown off balance mm-hmm. in nature.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, and I know we've talked in shows past about religion and how religion goes into society and how we work, but also I'm also really interested about this battle between religion and science.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think about just the natural order. You know, despite whatever you believe, you know that there's a world order that goes on. And the fact that it's almost like the butterfly effect, that something, it takes something, and even a meteor the size of London would only elongate the day.
One half second. But at the same time, destroy everything that we ever know. I mean, the fact that a half-mile meteor would kill everything on Earth is insane to me.
It only takes half a mile for John Hansen to ruin a shirt in 100-degree weather. I mean, let alone...
That is that's very kind of you to say that. Yeah, you're right. A walk at Chipotle nearly killed me. But it would kill
you.
Everything.
I mean, the walking asteroid, they call him.
You did get really deep there, Domity, but it is interesting. I made fun of that movie Armageddon and such, but it definitely, when they were trying to play out what that would look like, because I wonder, like, if there was news of that asteroid coming a couple days, you know, beforehand, how would we cover it? What would you do? What would you do if you had a week left on this planet and you knew there's nothing to do to stop this thing?
That is actually a good question for the listeners.
Yes.
312-981-7200. If you knew that an asteroid was coming to planet Earth and you had 1 week.
One whole week. Because if it's a day, I know what I'm doing. Some fun. I'm getting hammered and I'm going to go procreate. I don't know how to say it. I don't know. You know, I mean, why not? You got one more day left.
See, if I had a week left, a week is great because you can do that by Saturday.
Yes.
By the following Sunday, you're back in God's grace. Yeah. You're good. You're good.
Exactly.
Do some dirt and clean it up.
Well, in a week, you could go places. Although, I don't know, like, if airlines would still be operating. Like, the world would fall into chaos if it was ending in a week. Like, no one would go to work, of course, like that. Which means that none of our infrastructure would work at all. Anything like that. So 312-981-7200, we've got to take a quick commercial break. But I want to know, just hypothesize with us here. You can get deep, too. Are you praying? Are you trying any last things you can do? Let us know what you're doing if you've got a week left on this planet as we celebrate National Asteroid Day on 720 WGN. Got to get free falling on there. We got a couple questions out here. First of all, we're talking about National Asteroid Day. John Hansen and Domity Pongo in the house for David Plyer. And I don't know how we got on this kick. We are getting some deep stuff here, Domity.
We're getting into some deep stuff. It started with us talking about an asteroid. Asteroid Day, we're celebrating. And then looking at the likelihood of an asteroid hitting the Earth and what different size asteroids, what damage that could do to the planet. And it got us thinking, if a scientist released a story that said you have 1 week to live, there's an asteroid on its way barreling toward this planet, what would you do in that 1 week?
312-981-7200, talk or text. We'd love a phone call on this one. Let us know what you would do with 1 week left. But it's not only like, what would you do? Oh, we'd do this and this. I'd actually want to like walk through the feasibility if that would even be possible. Because my first thought, I love going to Las Vegas, right?
Uh-huh,
I love gambling. I'd take all my money and gamble. But how am I getting to Las Vegas if they've made this announcement? Is anyone flying any planes for that week? Is the commercial airline industry working? I'd like to think that some people are.
Yeah, because who's going to go to work?
What baggage worker is going to go to work and move bags around? Nobody.
There's going to be one guy like the one playing the violin on the Titanic that's like, I must finish these nights.
Yeah, the last Southwest Airlines pilot. He's divorced.
I'm finding that guy. I'm paying for that $5,000 plane ticket to St. Louis.
Well, that's another great question is that, I imagine there'd be skeptics out there, but there'd be those greedy people that wanted to make that last buck. So you'd have massive amounts of, inflation of prices, and with less and less work going around, I imagine that prices would go up. I don't know what they'd be saving the money for, but you never know.
We saw this with Y2K. We've been here before.
Really? People were stockpiling money. I mean, I know.
Not stockpiling money. Right. I mean, more like noodles.
Ramen, yes,
ramen,
exactly.
Noodles, water, bottles of water.
I know. I guess it would just be finding a way to go and see your family. But like, also, like, think about this: when you talk about people not going to work, who's moving gasoline around the country? Is anyone? I mean, are truck drivers really gonna?
Is everything stopping then and there?
Right, and then you're like, well, you know, my folks live out in Downers Grove. I would probably just walk, spend a day walking out there. So I can go hang out with my family in Downers Grove, I guess.
But you bring me back to what I feel is at the crux of this question, which is the things that we do, what actually matters, right? I think very few of us are lucky enough to have a gig that, you know, whether if the world were ending, you'd be doing this thing because you love it so much right until it goes down. Like, there are broadcasters who wouldn't leave the studio. They'd be reporting you to the end of the earth. I don't know if I'm one of them. But
right. No, but that's a good point.
You know what I mean?
Because people would want to listen. People, I think, we work in radio and TV. I think people would still want to consume that information. And you're right. We do.
And we feel we would feel an obligation to give that information. I even think about, I hate to take it to this place, but you can't help but think about it because of what happened at the Capitol Gazette and that shooting with those five people injured. When we walk into WGN Radio, there's now a security guard right there on our floor. Politeness can be great to have him there, but it just reminds you. I saw Amy Guth actually tweeted this. She says, you know, I'm happy to see increased security, but there's a lump in my throat as I think about this is where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes me think about the jobs that we do and the sense of duty that we feel in doing these jobs.
Right. And that news staff published a paper the next day. The Capitol.
Next day. I would have been like, everyone is off.
You're done.
You're done. Everybody's off. Everybody. No, this is what gives you purpose.
Yeah, you're right. I think GN would still be here for that last week.
Yeah.
We'd have some countdown. I'm sure that the Imogene would come up with some great end of the world countdown production liners and stuff, and we would just rock it out. Get everyone one last 1 hour shift and just rock it out.
And I feel like
Cochran until the end.
The sales team would still be grinding it out. Gatorade, it'd be Armageddonade. The John and Doma T show sponsored by.
Absolutely. Get those last. Every business out there is going to spend the last money. Why not? I just find this conversation fascinating because we talk about the last dinner. What would you actually do? 7979 says, if at all possible, I'd take my whole family to the opposite side of the earth from the strike zone and hope that the road isn't the end of that. It isn't human destiny. And they would probably know exactly where it would hit. But we're talking about, like we say in the article, half a mile wide, that's going to destroy everything, no matter where you are. I get the need to want to go across the other earth, but how are you going to get there? Like, I don't think that is humanly possible to move when no one is working.
That's
this is fascinating.
True. That's very true. And you know, there's this old saying, it's a bit of a cliche, but it's so true. They say, when a person's, you know, facing his last days, he's not thinking about how many more hours he could spend at work. He's thinking about how much more time he could spend with his family.
Which is a great segue, Doma, to you've offered to us, to Paul. Paul, you're listening down in Georgia. Paul, you're on WGN.
Ah, good morning.
All right, Paul, thanks for a call from Georgia. All right, so you got 1 week left to live. What are you doing?
Spend it with, mostly with family.
Do they live nearby to you, Paul, or?
No, I've got some family near me. My family's scattered all over the country right now.
Mm-hmm.
All the way from Seattle to
the other side, East Coast to West Coast. Hey, Paul, I got to ask you, though. So are you retired, Paul?
Yes, I am.
What did you do when you were working?
Electronics engineering.
Okay, that's an awesome gig. Would you go to work on the last week of your life to live?
Probably not.
So then what, I mean, so when you talk about electrical engineering, what systems would fail? Like, I mean, you mentioned you'd want to see your family there all across the country. I don't think any airline pilots are going to be flying for that week. If you had left as an electrical engineer your job, what's nationwide systems are breaking down because you're not going to work?
Well, I wouldn't be involved with nationwide systems because of electronics, not electrical.
Oh, okay.
Got it.
But no one's fixing their computer. Paul, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Yeah, I think that, again, the family thing is great. I'm just trying to think, like, locally, if you can't get out of Chicago, what are you doing? Aren't playing.
No.
I ain't going to go see a Cubs game. That's what I'd want to do, in theory. Airplane. I don't know. I just find this fascinating because I really wonder what you
could
do.
It's good stuff.
I think a lot of us would.
I know you said that one day. I'm really curious. I know one day you ball out, live it up.
Literally. And no, it would be the family thing, of course. I think that is like a go-to. And luckily, again, they're close enough within 21 miles that if I can't drive there because the interstate system is packed with people moving around, I could walk there, literally. If I had a week, I'd spend 5 hours walking out to Downers Grove or running out there. And, yeah, my parents got a little stockpile of booze downstairs. I know. And in high school, I would steal some of it. So I know it's there somewhere. And, yeah, I'd have some fun. I guess I would just relax. I mean, I'm one of those people that I like to have control over everything. I'm also a worrier. But that would be the moment where I'm like, hey, I mean, there's nothing you can do now.
I would find myself reassessing things. And I'd probably go with family. I'd pray. I'm a prayer.
Yeah?
I pray. Even in meditation, I would sit and meditate with family, but then I would try to find a way to write something and leave it somewhere, like just in case some life form. Yes.
You're digging a hole in the backyard as far down as it goes.
I'm going to try to bury my manifesto somewhere so it can be fun. I'm going to get a slab and chisel something. Yeah. Leave my mark on this planet. I really would.
Cave painting somewhere, just anything.
Absolutely. Even though everything is being destroyed, I would be silly enough to think my post-it note would survive Armageddon.
Right.
I'm telling you, man.
815 says, repent, repent, repent. The very wealthy will try to hack it out. You're right about that. I would put together water and canned foods and also some liters of wood, propane, all that stuff. Hey, what do I got to lose? So it sounds like 7 or 815 is trying to gut it out, trying to make it past the apocalypse.
Thinks he's going to, hey, he might make it. Yeah, that's Noah right there. He's building the ark.
Yeah, I don't think no ark's going to survive that. 312-981-7200.
We've got Glenn.
Yeah, let's get to Glenn here. Glenn, what would you do out of Calumet Park? What are you doing in Calumet Park in the last week you got?
I go to the nearest forest reserve and go camping and just take in nature. You know?
Yeah, I like that.
That makes a lot of sense. I like that.
Yeah, just go to the forest preserve and have a good time. Right, Glenn?
Right. Just go camping and just enjoy all the beauty around you.
That's a good answer, Glenn. I appreciate the phone call. Thank you. 312-981-7200. If you got any other ones, we're going to take a quick commercial break here on 720 WGN.
Thank you, Roger. Domati Pungo here with John Hansen filling in for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So I'm really excited about this guest. I had a chance to meet her several years ago and really related to her passion for mentorship and to mentor young black men specifically. And you meet some people that you wish you had them when you were young, when you were in high school. Tanisha Taylor Bell is one of those people. She was an executive producer. It's so true, Tanisha. She was an executive producer formerly for CNN as a PR professional. But the reason we're talking to her this morning, she is the founder of the Ezekiel Taylor Scholarship Fund. And they're having a gala coming up on July 28th, which I'm honored to be a part of in some capacity. I'll be one of the presenters. But Tanisha, thank you for coming on so early in the morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you giving the time to such a worthy cause.
Well, we need people like you in our community for sure. And I'm so glad and humbled that you allowed me to be a part of what you have going on. And I was reading up on you and not only just about, you know, your family life and your career, but also about what makes you passionate. Because Tanisha, when she's been very outspoken in several op-eds about how Chicago's gun violence should be dealt with and handled. So before we even go into your family, who you are, some of these op-eds have kind of caught my attention. I remember you wrote a piece that said you wouldn't raise children in Chicago if you had the opportunity because of how viscerally you've been affected by Chicago's gun violence. Before we jump into anything, just walk us through that piece and that thinking and what you meant by that.
Yeah, well, let me give the background to those who don't know. My father was killed right there on 79th and Stony Island, a victim of gun violence, not by his choice, was robbed, coming from church one night, was carjacked and it went wrong, and it cost him his life, unfortunately. And so fast forward, that was 1982, and fast forward to today in 2018, the same gun violence that you saw then, you see more rapid today, and obviously with social media and media more prevalent, you can see more of it happening. And it's sad. You know, our children can't play in the streets like we used to do. You know, our children can't walk down the street to school. They can't go to certain parks to have a good time. They can't march in parade. I mean, look at Hydea Pendleton. I mean, there's so many cases, and you can name children back to back down the list, unfortunately, that have lost their lives innocently for just being kids, you know, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that shouldn't be. And so I have a young son, and he's 7 years old, and he's my world. He's my investment, and everything that I pour into him, my fear is that he runs into the child that maybe their parent didn't pour into them or their parent did invest in them. And then that child looks at my child and says, hey, I want your sneakers or I want your jacket or I want your car. And it's unfortunate, you know, for that child and my child, you know, they're both our children. You know, we're the village. And when we don't invest into our children, this is what happens. And so That is the fear. You know, as you mentioned, I am an executive. Well, I was an executive at CNN for 13 years, and that's based here in Atlanta. And I just feel, you know, when I come home, I get nervous, you know, driving down the street, the same street that my father was killed on, Stony Island. And no matter where I am, and you hear the cases of people being shot in the wrong place at the wrong time, as I mentioned. And so having him there sometimes makes me nervous. And so I do come home often. I'm in Chicago just about every month, and we're together. And but I do feel safer sometimes that our home base is in Atlanta. You know, I feel safer for him walking to the park or playing outside. And it's just a different cultural way of life, and it's sad that it happens that way, because I love Chicago so much.
Right. Yeah. And why I started there is because there was something I didn't know, even if in how long I've known the story of your father, Ezekiel. I didn't know who it was that robbed and killed him. How old were the people that carried this out?
Very young, Damati, very young. Ages 15, 19, and 21.
Wow. So when I thought,
and I say that, and I say that because someone could have poured into those young people. Someone could have told those young people to make positive life choices. Someone could have been mentors to them. Someone could have given them opportunities. And if that would have happened, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation today. My father probably would still be here.
Yeah,
Tanisha, how old were you when your? This is John Hansen, by the way. How old were you when your father was killed?
Hey, John, I was 5. I was very young, so more than 35 years ago.
Do you remember that day? Not to take you back there, but I'm just kind of curious. You know, as a 5-year-old, I look back at certain big moments, obviously. I think I can remember 4 or 5. Do you remember that and the aftermath, you know, kind of the first year or so after that, the difference that meant for your family?
Yeah, my mom became a single mom, which was very unfortunate, at the age of 31. Oh. A single mom, a widow, and back in the day, you know, you married your college sweetheart and you really didn't have to do much because the man took care of everything, and so she didn't go to college, and that wasn't really required that much, you know, back in those times. And so she had to find her way, you know, she had to find her education at that point and go back to school and fend for herself and this young little girl named Tanisha. But I do remember the night. I remember the night she got the call. Being at home, I remember his funeral. So there are little things here or there. Mm-hmm. At the time, my parents were also raising my cousins, their nieces, Ocella Taylor and Cynthia Taylor, and they're much older than I am. And so I have to rely on them a lot to fill in the blanks that I have, because my dad was their dad, you know, and so they tell me how he walked and what he smelled like and his swag and what they loved about him. And, you know, I have to rely on my cousins to tell me about my own dad. And it's sad sometimes. You know, I'm glad they were there in the home. But, yeah, I have to rely on other people to tell me what my dad was really like.
You know, there's something telling about what it is that your dad meant to you. He had a picture of you in his pocket when he passed away.
Yeah, and that is what made my mom really nervous, because his address obviously was in his pocket, and his, a picture of me was in his pocket when they found his body. And so they knew that the murderers knew who I was and who she was and where he lived. And so she lived in fear for a very long time, as you can imagine. So she kept a very close eye and close watch on me growing up.
Tanisha, your story, I think it's impacting me in a way that I hadn't thought, because obviously it's a tragic story, but I think that when we talk about violence, we often talk about the here and now, but hearing you so many years later, not remembering what your dad smelled like and having to rely on that, it just kind of brings home the fact that when people are shot and killed on our streets, it's not only the present that's affected. You're losing generation. You're losing stories. You're losing memories. You're losing things that impact people for decades throughout their lives, or their kids' lives, or their kids' kids' lives, not being able to pass those memories on.
Absolutely. I mean, think about the generations of people that won't be born because their parent was killed. You know, these young people are killed at the ages of 19 and 15, and it's really sad. So, you know, they have an opportunity, or they would have had opportunity to have children and grandchildren who would have become lawyers and doctors and dentists and psychiatrists, and all of that is lost. And then the memories that come with it, you know, what happened in that moment in April of in 1982 still impacts me as a grown woman who's more than 40 years old, you know, all these years later, you know, how I deal with my son and what I'm able to tell him and what I remember and what my relationships are with, you know, men that I date. You know, it's like, you know, the whole father-daughter situation and things that happen in that moment, people don't realize that, yes, it impacts generations and generations. And Dr. King, Dr. Bernice King, as you know, Dr. Martin Luther King's daughter, the King Center is a client of mine here in Atlanta. And she talks a lot about how the, you know, the killers of her dad, the killer of her dad didn't just take him or the movement, but how it impacted her as a little girl and being an adult now. And she just tweeted the other day, it was the anniversary of her grandmother, Dr. King's mother, Alberta King, being killed right in the church at Ebenezer, and how gun violence has rocked the King violence, not just rocked the King family, not just Dr. King, but his mother. And for generations after that, you know, how it's impacted her as a grown woman who's, you know, more than 50 years old. You know, people don't think that gun violence is not just in that moment, but it's about the generations after that as well.
Well, similar to Bernice King, you're keeping the name, the legacy of your father moving forward through the Ezekiel Taylor Scholarship Fund. We're talking to Tanisha Taylor Bell, a PR professional and the executive director and founder of the Ezekiel Taylor Scholarship Fund. And we're finding out more about her life and what inspired her to create the scholarship and how you can help out if you two are have been affected by this or want to invest in people who have been affected by this so that they can move forward and we can create that next generation of people who, you know, those doctors and lawyers that she talked about. And just a moment on 720 WGN.
I was born by the river.
You heard my note to Curtis there because I love this song. I'm like, let this play out and fade it out a little slowly for me because this Sam Cooke is one of my favorite singers ever. And we're talking to Tanisha Taylor Bell. This is Doma T. Pongo and John Hanson on 720 WGN. And we're talking to the executive director and founder of the Ezekiel Taylor Scholarship Fund. And I found out this was one of Ezekiel Taylor's favorite songs right there.
Yes, that. Oh, you're about to make me cry over here, Doma T. I love Sam Cooke, and my father loved Sam Cooke. He loved music. And that was the song that I announced the Scholarship Foundation in his name and in his honor. That was the song I used in the video that went viral more than 2 years ago. And when I hear it, I just think about what we have to do as a people. You know, Sam Cooke said a change is going to come. And we have to believe that. We have to stay focused and we have to stay positive. But if we all do our part, you know, change happens when ordinary people get together and do extraordinary things. And that was Sam Cooke's message in that song. You know, change is going to come. And what we see what's happening in the streets of Chicago with our young people and the gun violence, change can happen and it's going to come. But it's up to us. It's up to us to make a difference.
So what's happening July 28th? And once again, I know I keep saying it, but I'm so grateful to be a part of this event because I just lost a very good friend of mine last fall. And lately, as I do these events, and as you know, I'm in the community a lot and I talk a lot about violence and whatnot. And I'd been affected by gun violence, but I think this was the closest person that probably passed away. And it gave me a new passion for figuring out what it is that we can do to affect the lives of so many other people. And you're doing that day in, day out. So tell us what's going on July 28th and how we can help support the work that you're doing.
Yes, everyone who's listening, we need your support. These young men who've also been impacted by gun violence will be celebrated on Saturday, July 28th at the Chicago Hilton right over there on 93rd and Cicero. It's our second annual gala and silent auction. We have a really good time doing what our community doesn't do a lot, and that's celebrate young men, celebrate young African-American men. A lot of times we talk about, you know, the robberies and the deaths and the gun violence and the shootings and the bad. And it can be depressing, you know, watching the news and listening to the news. And we think, like, is there hope? Are there any young, great men out there? You know, what does our future look like? Well, this is a great example of what our future looks like. These are young men who have arose to the occasion to beat out other other young men for scholarships, for the Ezekiel Taylor Scholarship. And so we celebrate them on that night. We have a good time. We honor them. We award them. We have entertainment. This year we have Stevie Wonder's lead saxophonist, who was a saxophonist for Prince, Ryan Kilgore. So he will bring us entertainment. He's played for so many celebrities like Toni Braxton and Mary J. Blige and Tyler Perry shows. And so he's a wonderful entertainer that we're going to have that evening. And we just celebrate them. Tickets are on sale at our website, eztaylor.org. And that's the letter E, the letter Z, taylor.org. And the entire community, everyone who's listening, is invited. So bring your family, friends, and coworkers. And just get ready to just celebrate our community and the best in our community and encourage them, because a lot of times these young people don't have the encouragement that they need to make the right choices. And just like gang members are recruiting, we have to recruit.
We have to encourage too.
And so people ask me, well, who is the competition to your scholarship foundation? I guess they expected me to talk about other scholarship foundations. And I said, no, our competition is the streets, the gangbangers, because they're going after the same very boys that we're going after, and we have to win.
You know, I love it. I love it so much because, you know, when my friend passed away, and I tell the story, they're like, I mean, you know, you're almost 30, you're in broadcasting, you've made it, so to speak, out of this quagmire that we call the streets. But I don't know how people understand that when you're rebuilding your community from scratch, or you're the first in your family to make it to a certain space, you're not that far removed from some of these people. Some of your best friends, your childhood friend, the guy who grew up in the sandbox with you, was one decision away from either going to the college or university that you went to, or standing on that corner and doing what it is that he did. And it doesn't change your friendship. It just changed the nature of it. And I guess my question is to you, Tanisha, what types of struggles have you seen with some of these young men? Because you have an ongoing mentorship program. And a lot of these young men, one of the most vulnerable times for them is that first year after high school, when they go away to college and then they come back and forth from home to college, and they have this tug and pull between the streets and what their life could be. It's a very frustrating and confusing time for a lot of young men. But you have a mentorship program. Talk a bit about that program and what some of the challenges that you help these young men get through.
Absolutely. It's a force, Damati. There's a positive force and there's a negative force, right? And so we all have to make choices. We're all presented with the same choices. I mean, we've all been probably presented with to make negative choices or positive choices in our lives, right? And so if you don't have the right people pouring into you and investing into you and telling you how important you are and telling you how great you are, you know, like the movie The Help, you know, you was kind, you was pretty, you was important, you know?
Yes.
And so if you don't have those people pouring into you, you will fall victim of making the wrong choice. And so that is why the village is so important. That is why parenting is so important. That is why teachers, I don't understand why teachers are the lowest paid. They have the greatest job on the face of this earth, and they deserve all the accolades and the pay that they can get. You know, that is why these roles are so important. And so that's why mentorship is important. And that's why for us at the Ezekiel Taylor Scholarship Foundation, it was very important to pair every young man with a mentor that provides you with life skills, you know, someone to tell you, you know, young men will face all types of obstacles. They will face, you know, maybe their girlfriend got pregnant, or maybe they got an F on a test, or maybe they're not making enough money, or maybe they feel tempted to sell drugs to be able to pay their car note. They will face all types of life choices. And so the goal is for our foundation to be an extended family, okay, wow, to tell them, young man, you can make it, you can do it. And for our mentors to even to use their life and their stories and what their choices were to help the young man, the scholar, to say, hey, I can make it. I can make better choices. And so the more people we have to be their family, to be their village, to constantly pour into them, constantly invest in them, we can save them, you know, one student at a time. You can't save everybody. I get it.
Right.
But at least if we're making a difference in one student at a time each year, this year we've got 18 boys, and we're so excited. We're so excited for them. And our goal is for them to see it through, for us to be with them all the way through their 4 years of college and deposit them back into society so they can turn around and pay it forward and do the same thing. So we're starting a new cycle. We're breaking the generational curse.
That's what I was just going to get at, Tanisha, with these mentorship programs. you know, it does. It stops that cycle of back and forth. And also I wanted to ask, and I imagine you guys get great feedback too, not only is it great for these young men, clearly, obviously, for you mentioned that cycle and the positivity, but also for people that end up mentoring these. I mean, you can be changed by the people that you mentor. So the mentees, I imagine, get a lot out of it too, and that helps bring everyone together in many ways.
Oh, let me tell you, our mentors are wonderful men, professional men throughout the city, and I can name them all. They've been doing a wonderful job. Jamil Simmons is our chairperson for the board, for the mentors. And let me tell you, his mentee goes to UIC and needed a suit jacket to go to a convention a couple of weeks ago down in Florida. And he was so excited to get him a jacket and get down there and give him a worksheet. He had a wardrobe because we want our young boys. We do have a Dress for Success program as well. Last year we outfitted with cups and suits for all of our boys, actually, because we wanted to make sure they had suits, dressed for success, and that they were prepared to enter the professional world. And Jamil was so excited to get down to UIC and help this young man get ready for his conference that he was going to. And so it makes them happy. They've done a wonderful job interacting with these young men throughout the school year and staying on top of them with their internships and their grades. And Chad Edmonds is another great mentor there, and Bakari Baker. The list goes on and on. Timothy Jones. I mean, these men have really poured into these young boys, and they, too, are learning themselves, and I think it's just it's a win-win on both sides.
I love it. There were 11 Ezekiel Taylor scholars in 2017, one of them coming back as a presenter. He works at WSAV-TV. Darius Johnson will be presenting. He's one of the people emceeing the event.
That's awesome.
The second annual gala. So, I mean, when you talk about that mentor-mentee relationship, I'm going to be one of those people. I'm not a mentor just yet. I'm going to mentor the next cycle.
Come on, Delma, you get it going.
I know. This coming cycle, I'm getting myself together. But I get a chance to be peers with some of these people who have gone through the program. And Art Norman from NBC5 is going to be the master of ceremonies there. It's at EZTaylor.org, where you can grab your tickets. I'll be there as well, supporting my sister Tanisha. Thank you so much for all you do for the community and for waking up this early morning and talking to us about this. I appreciate it, for real.
Hey, when you're passionate and you're trying to change lives and change the trajectory of people, young people, and where they're going, no matter what time, you'll do it. And if Diamond T and John are calling, you're definitely going to do it. So, thank you guys so much.
Well, we know that's a lie because we've already had one guest drop on us. So, thank you so much.
Same on them.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. You can find out more about the Ezekiel Taylor Scholarship Foundation at eztaylor.org. Listen to Doma T. Pungo and John Hanson on 720 WGN.
This is Dean Richards with your Sunday morning.
This is Dean Richards.
Hollywood.
Hollywood.
Movie reviews, A-list interviews, theater, music, and food time.
You've got talent, kid.
Plus, all your Sunday morning news.
Morning. Dean Richards, Sunday morning at 9 on 720 WGN.
Hey, Roger, by the way, what would you do if it was the last week on Earth? I don't know if you heard our conversation.
Yeah, I did. I had two ideas.
All right.
Both require massive pre-planning.
Okay.
So the first one would be to dig down as deep as possible into the core and build my my safety room.
Okay.
It actually would be an underground amusement park.
Yeah, okay.
The other would be to take a rocket into space, land on that sucker, and ride it all the way down.
Well, so you're going with the realistic options.
Well,
here.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. What else is there?
Yeah, we know, both you and I, that you'd be, even if it came on a Sunday morning, you'd be doing the news at 3.
I'd be standing outside the window, hanging outside this window. I'd punch out one of these windows. I'd hang outside like I used to, and I'd wash the windows in our old apartment.
Yeah.
And I'd be saying, now here it comes. Yeah, I'd be reporting up to the last second, baby. You know it.
You'd do the countdown. 3:32 on the Sunday morning news time. Here's Roger Bennett. WGN, John Hanson and Doma T. Pungo, joined now by David Shostokas here on 720 WGN. David, let's first of all just make sure, say hello so we make sure that mic is working.
Hello.
Hey,
good morning, everybody.
That's it. That's all for you, David.
All right, thanks. It's been great, guys.
David, we chatted last year. We got a chance to talk about the Declaration of Independence, and we're coming up on the 4th of July week. And I thought it was fitting that here we are on the morning of July the 1st, chatting a few days before we celebrate Independence Day, and we can start to dispel some of the myths behind the signing of the Declaration of Independence, all that sort of stuff. But I thought we'd kind of, I don't want to back up too much because we could go way back in history before 1776. But first and foremost, how did you get passionate about this subject? And tell us about the book that you've written about it that we talked about last year.
Well, we talked about it last year. And of course, John, thanks for having me back. This is now now a tradition,
yes,
because it's 2 years in a row. And so it's always great to be part of a tradition. The book is called Creating the Declaration of Independence. And it really leads up. It's about the few weeks before the Declaration of Independence gets signed, and starts out with Richard Henry Lee on June 7th, 1776. And he was the first guy to actually say in public the word independence,
mm-hmm.
because it was really a very dangerous thing to do.
I don't think people understand. I think that we know history and we know that they were, you know, they went against the king, and we have glorified versions of that. But this meant their heads.
Literally, because we're talking about independence was doing, because they always pretended that they weren't fighting against the king. Washington and his guys were out fighting around Lexington, Concord, Bunker Hill. But the fact is they always pretended that they were fighting against the parliament and the ministers of the king. Because if they were fighting against the king, that was treason. And treason involved very unpleasant activities,
mm-hmm.
among them being hung to begin with, or hanged, as the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
But they cut you down before you died. And then after they cut you down, then they'd cut your guts out.
What?
And then after they cut your guts out, then they'd burn them in front of you while you were still alive, supposedly, theoretically. And then eventually they would cut your head off and then draw and quarter the rest of you and spread it around the kingdom.
So these men knew that once this independence had been declared, that they would be full traitors, I guess, at that point.
They would be full traitors at that point. And strangely enough, I used to be a Cook County prosecutor, and of course I've been in criminal justice system for a long time as an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
as an attorney. But, you know, there's really draconian penalties in the law for many, many things, and seldom does anybody get it. But in fact, there was a fellow by the name of Dr. Joseph Warren that subsequent to Bunker Hill, and Dr. Warren was, in fact, John Adams' personal physician, physician for his family, so they knew Dr. Warren very well. And subsequent to Bunker Hill, actually, Dr. Warren had his head cut off.
Wow.
So the British, there was a British death squad that went around seeing if anybody was still alive on the battlefield. And if they were still alive, they were making sure that they weren't anymore. And among the things that they did was cut off Dr. Warren's head. Which is, strangely enough, they didn't know it was Dr. Warren's head for a long, long time. but as it turns out, Paul Revere...
Mm-hmm.
Was a silversmith, mm-hmm. But he also did dental work.
Oh, wow. So it was early dental records that did it?
It was the first record of forensic dentistry.
Wow.
That they identified Dr. Warren's head with Paul Revere's fillings in his head.
Okay.
So this was serious business.
Right, yeah. I don't know
if we're talking about Sopranos or American history.
Well, no, and I think we glorify this time period, and they are, you know, heroes, and they wrote not only the Declaration of Independence, but the Founding Fathers did some incredible things. They got lucky along the way about 100,000 times to be able to get to where we are today. But to put it in perspective, so June, where Henry Lee declares it publicly, but there had been murmurs for a while about something.
There had been murmurs for a while. Among the colonies, different colonies had been passing resolutions for independence, but in the Second Continental Congress, nobody would utter in public the word independence. They did it over a beer in City Tavern,
right?
You know, which is where actually Jefferson and Adams got together and first outlined the Declaration of Independence over a beer. But they would not say it publicly, because doing that publicly puts you out on a limb. And Richard Henry Lee was the very first person to do that. He was from Virginia, and he was the first person to do that. Then John Adams seconded the motion, And then, of course, they did what legislatures usually do. They appointed a few committees.
Right. Well, because when you think about it, it's easy to say, oh, independence, here we are. But it's not like everything started on July the 4th, 1776. We're going back decades of, and we don't have to go back together and do this. But the First Continental Congress came to certain resolutions and sent their message across the sea and waited for a response to come back. So I guess the timing of it, had the king responded to what the First Continental Congress had come up with and their demands before Henry Lee had said that? When did that kind of, what called the Second Continental Congress together?
Well, the First Continental Congress had originally, at the urging of John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, had sent what they called the Olive Branch Petition to the king. And the king actually rejected out of hand the Olive Branch Petition and did not want to accept it. And actually, Dickinson really, by the 4th of July, 2nd of July, which is a separate story from the 4th, had not gone along with what people wanted with independence. And Pennsylvania was on the split. In fact, that's why Benjamin Franklin, who was from Pennsylvania, he was not among the people to propose independence, because they proposed it as states. Right. They represented states, and the state of Pennsylvania was split and not entirely in favor of independence. And so they did not. And so that left and Virginia was really the main mover and shaker for a couple of reasons, one of which is John Adams couldn't do it because Massachusetts had been where all this stuff happened. Lexington, right. Concord, Bunker Hill.
The Boston Tea Party, everything.
All that good stuff. Boston was the, and Massachusetts was the hotbed of the movement. And so they didn't want Massachusetts to do the proposal, even though Adams would have been a prime candidate to do that. He was the only one really pushing heavily for it. But the politics of it were such that Massachusetts, if Massachusetts were to propose it, it would seem like Massachusetts was trying to drag everybody into their into their argument.
You needed the big Southern state.
You needed a big Southern state. So the politics of the matter were really, really important.
Well, these were sophisticated politicians. And my question is, how did they keep, with the stakes so high, how did they keep some of these plans from leaking? From getting back to the king, there weren't any moles within this.
Well, there were moles, there were spies, there were other things. But you got to remember, we didn't have
Twitter.
The internet.
Right.
Somebody sending a carrier pigeon in a month, he's going to know everything you're planning.
yeah. It was like it took about 6 weeks, generally speaking, to get news from Philadelphia to London. For them to know, and then another 6 weeks for them to come back. But by this time, British troops, 30,000 British troops, were already on their way.
Okay.
Oh, really?
They were already on their way before independence was declared, and that was among the reasons why they had just a year earlier actually appointed George Washington the commander in chief of the Continental Army.
Now, I don't want to spoil this piece of the book, but because time was of the essence, Thomas Jefferson, created this document in record timing. How was he able to do it? It's something you talk about in the book.
It is something we talk about in the book, but strangely enough, it's not. My legal experience, the Declaration of Independence is kind of an interesting document if you kind of analyze it a little bit, and if you put it side by side with a criminal complaint, or a civil complaint, any kind of complaint to law. The complaint to law, generally speaking, has a statement of the law, a statement of the facts. It applies the law to the facts, and then in the end, it comes out with the prayed for resolution of the issue is. And basically, that's what Thomas Jefferson did. He did a statement of the law and utilized the law of nature and of nature's God, which is kind of a very, very important situation that we never talk about.
Okay.
And then he talked about the grievances that the king, all their grievances against the king, denial of trial by jury, imposition of taxes, no taxation without representation, searches with general warrants. There was 28 complaints against the king. And then applying these facts to the law that was proposed at the beginning, the law of nature and nature's God. And then, of course, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then whenever government and governments are instituted among men for the purpose of fulfilling those rights, and they derive their legitimate powers from the consent of the governed. Okay,
this man, you got that whole thing down. That was pretty good.
Packed. this is the statement of law. Uh-huh. Okay, and so you take this law, apply the facts. That is the king's their grievances against the king.
Right.
And then in the end, what's the resolution when you apply the law to the facts? Independence.
Gotta go.
Right.
Independence.
We gotta take a quick commercial break. I wanna talk more about the lead up to the document. You mentioned the committee, the writing, and some of the words that get changed here or there to get the declaration to where it is as we read it here today. Quick break here on 720 WDGN. All right, here with David
Shostokis. Perfect.
Shostokis. Finally, something harder than Doma T. Pongo.
Finally. Something harder than Pongo, I don't think.
Right. So we're talking about the declaration of independence. We're coming up on July the 4th. Okay, so we're walking through the weeks before, because I love the storytelling aspect of this. So we're in June. Henry Lee declares or mentions independence for the first time.
Well, actually, Richard Henry Lee.
Oh, Richard Henry Lee, yep.
Mm-hmm. Richard Henry Lee proposes. He walks into the Continental Congress on June the 6th, 1776, and offers a resolution in support of independence. And as we left off was that, in fact, what was Congress's response? They appointed three committees.
Mm-hmm.
They appointed three committees. One committee was for the purpose of outlining the structure of a new government, should in fact they decide to declare independence. Another committee was to...
They're already thinking about a new government, even in 1776, before they've... fought a war to create that new government.
Right, exactly. They decide they're going to put together a plan for a new government, which ultimately turned out to be the Articles of Confederation.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And then they also put together a committee for the purpose of contacting foreign nations, ideally for some support, France. Spain.
The Netherlands
for financing France and Spain, hopefully to remain neutral, and France hopefully to get some military support.
So when you say committee, you mean figuring out who to reach out to, I mean who to literally send across the ocean to be emissaries and talk to these countries and try and convince these people.
Precisely.
You can't do it over the internet, you can't make phone calls, you got to send these people in boats and say, Spain, please stay neutral, France, please give us your troops. Give us your Navy, more importantly than anything. And okay, so that's one committee. Then the third committee?
And the third committee was the committee to write a declaration just on the off chance that they would adopt Lee's resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Because they tabled the resolution. Because at that time, Adams seconded it, and then nobody else went out on this treason limb besides Adams and Richard Henry Lee at the time. So they tabled it and put off a vote until July the 2nd. And this was June the 6th. So they put together this committee. And the committee has Ben Franklin and John Adams, Thomas Jefferson.
Some big names there.
Right.
That's a good committee.
Who's who right here?
Yeah.
fellow by the name of Roger Sherman and another fellow by the name of Robert Livingston. Sherman and Livingston, and actually, as it turns out, the bunch of them, nobody's thinking that this is really a very important job.
Really?
Really.
Nobody's thinking it's a terribly important job. Thomas Jefferson would rather be in Virginia. Virginia's writing a new constitution. He's promoted several ideas in a new constitution, including one idea that he wanted in the constitution that would provide for the extinction of slavery, strangely enough.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to be in Williamsburg to be defending it. But... that was not to be. Ben Franklin decided that they asked Ben if he would write it because he was the premier penman of the day. And Franklin said, "No, you know, I never write anything that's going to be edited by a committee."
Right. Can you bring us into this time frame, though? Because every time you talk to history makers, they never know when they're making history. They're just doing what it feels natural to do. But bring us into that time. How could they not see this as massively important?
They clearly did. They clearly did. This was an unusual generation.
But the actual specific writing of the document itself.
The document itself, they did not find that important.
They didn't think the creation of the document was really that important. They knew that this was important times. They knew what they were trying to do was going to be something special. But they didn't really understand that the document was going to be as important as it has become.
And something that we, hundreds of years later, go back to.
Yes.
We continue to check ourselves against this document. It's literally been, even as we talk about the slavery issue, it's been the cornerstone of the argument that freed Americans have been making since then.
There's no question about it. I would suggest that without Jefferson and the structure of the Declaration of Independence, it's not... Martin Luther King would not have had the prime arguments that he had.
Wow.
In terms of, in fact, one of the elements of the I Have a Dream speech, mm-hmm. is he says, all we are asking America to do is to live up to what has been written,
mm-hmm.
and referring to the Declaration of Independence.
Absolutely.
So what has been written? So they sit down. So Thomas Jefferson, does he go into a corner and write it
right.
by himself?
No.
Have a couple
of
beers?
No, they appoint the committee. A couple days later, Adams and Jefferson are at City Tavern, where most of the important business, Adams says most of the important business actually took place at City Tavern.
No shock.
Right. You know, which is still open today. You can go have a beer at City Tavern. And I've done so. I've had some ale that's brewed to Jefferson's recipe.
Okay.
It's fantastic. It's a fabulous trip. It feels like there's ghosts there. Actually, it burned down, but it was rebuilt to the same specifications from insurance records. But that's a whole separate story. So at any rate, Jefferson and Adams go. And they talk about what the structure of the document is going to be, and they talk about who's going to be doing things. And there are a couple of lawyers, and they arrive at that using that civil complaint or criminal complaint structure that we talked about earlier in the first segment. And that's it for the day. They just have a beer and go away. Because Adams is on like 20 different committees. He's a really, really busy guy. And he recently had been appointed to the chairman of the Board of Warden Ordnance. And he was thinking that was more important than this declaration business.
Because that sounds riveting.
Yeah. Right.
So about 2 days later, Jefferson and Adams get together again, and Jefferson says, well, did you talk to the other guys about what we talked about? And they said, yeah, and they all agree on our format for the declaration. He says, well, then Jefferson says to Adams, he says, well, then you're probably going to go ahead and write it. No, you're going to go ahead and draft it. Adams says, no, I don't think so. He says, really, I think, Tom, I think you're the guy to do that.
That's big for John Adams, because John Adams liked to do almost everything.
And it's huge for Adams. It's huge for Adams, but that tells you how important Adams thought this was. Adams actually, curiously enough, there's something that happened March 15th a couple of months earlier that Adams had done that he thought was people are going to follow him and find him in history as author in the real declaration. But they were wrong because it was all legal mumbo-jumbo.
Mm-hmm. So he deferred to Jefferson of Virginia with a better pen.
It was like a group project in college.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, you write it.
And then it's the day before, and so someone's got to do it. Yeah,
yeah.
It happened in a bar. Yeah, it's just like college.
And Tom says, well, but you know, you're the elder statesman, et cetera. So he says, well, a couple things. Number one, you're a Virginian. And we need somebody from Virginia to do this. And Richard Henry Lee actually had to leave town because his wife was sick. And so Jefferson was the Virginia left standing in that situation. He said, besides all that, he says, you know, people don't really like me very much.
Right.
And if because they think I'm obnoxious, and people generally like you. And so he says, as far as I'm concerned, you can write 10 times better than I can.
Right.
Mm.
And so Jefferson understands his flattery is just kind of
what it is.
What it is. Yeah, he's trying to get me to do this. And so Jefferson decides that, okay, I'll do it.
All right, we're going to get to what those words are and how they come to be. And then not only how they come to be in this country, the importance. I'd love to dive into how important they are, not only for this country, but for the world after they're written and spread all over the place. But you heard the tone. Actually, I'm going to stall for a little bit because there he is. Roger's getting up. He's taking a slow sojourn over there. Roger, what are you doing in Space Command?
I'm talking to Ms. Tashmani over here.
.720 WGN. Dave Plyer off tonight. So much, are you having a good time so far, man?
I'm having a really good time right now, man. I'm enjoying this a lot.
We're going on some deep rivers and creeks here. Well, even we're talking during the breaks, and we're just... The butterfly effect has come up a few times in our conversations.
Absolutely. We're talking about the end of the world to the founding of our country.
Yes. Like, we mentioned the butterfly effect, and David Shostakis joins us now, and he wrote Creating the Declaration of Independence, which is a great book, and we talked about this last year, too, but it's written in a way for a lot of people to understand, maybe that don't know a lot of the history. It's in I don't want to say simple text, but it's in text that people could understand.
Well, it's actually... in a story form,
yeah,
rather than a history. I mean, we start out with Richard Henry Lee, and we start out with him getting ready for the day and actually wind up, you remember Pongo, Dimitri?
Domiti.
Yes. See, I got my own problems.
Yeah.
But you find out that Richard Henry Lee's missing four of his fingers because they were blown off in a rifle accident.
Oh, my.
And he always wears a black satin glove to cover up the fact that... There's things in the book that make these people real.
Right.
There's things in the book that you learn a few things about City Tavern and the beer that Jefferson and Adams would drink, how much business. You know, people have business luncheons now, right?
Right.
And they would have business luncheons launch a country.
Yeah. Well, we talk about these names and how could they not be larger than life to us now? Of course, that's just the natural evolution of how we look back at our founding fathers or any of our presidents or what have you. But yeah, these were normal guys doing extraordinary things that got lucky a couple times along the way. So one way they got lucky was Thomas Jefferson penning quite a document. Where we left off is he's now he's part of a committee to write this thing. Adams has asked him to write it. And he accepts the task of writing it.
And he accepts the task of writing it. And when he accepts the task of writing it, he now has been tasked to do this essentially on his own. And he winds up locking himself in his second floor apartment at a place called Graff House. It was named after a bricklayer who built the house, Joseph Graff. Graff House is actually also burned down, but it's been rebuilt, so you can go and see the room, a recreation of the room where Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. Speaking of which, he wrote the Declaration of Independence on a chair that he invented.
Oh, the swivel, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah,
invented... When I hear about how these people invented these different things, I wonder what we'd be doing if not for Instagram. Like, would I be, like, creating a chair to sit in, like, finding new hobbies? Like, what are we doing with our lives right now? So he created this chair, and that was...
There was rollers on the windows. They have the windows go up and down. He took the rollers off of the windows, cut the seat of the chair off the seat... Took the window rollers, put them under the seat of the chair so that he could swivel back and forth, look out the window, turn to his desk. As we're sitting here swiveling, Thomas Jefferson invented the first swivel chair in the entire world while he was writing the Declaration of Independence.
That's insane. That's insane. All right.
Now, so, that one might be folklore. I'm calling folklore.
No,
isn't true?
No, it absolutely.
Okay, because he had slaves. Was he physically the one cutting them? Or what? No. I don't know. He had some help.
He did have help. I don't doubt that for a moment.
That's good enough point.
He did have a personal slave with him.
Oh, yes. Did he?
Yeah, he did. And that's why.
In Philadelphia?
In Philadelphia.
I know we're veering off the beaten path, but you talked about Abigail in the break. But, you know, Jefferson, he was one who didn't believe in the institution of slavery. Am I correct in that? In long form, even though he had slaves and is rumored to have had a mistress, he had a complex relationship with it.
He had a complex relationship with slavery, and he was quite well aware that when he penned the words, all men are created equal,
that
slavery was inconsistent. with the that element of the Declaration of Independence. There was at least three times during the course of his life that he did some things, one of which was a proposal that turned out to be part of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 that banned slavery forever in the Northwest Territories that ultimately would become Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, and Minnesota. Without and so Jefferson actually had this unusual relationship. He understood the inconsistencies. And sometime after 1787, the things that he had done to try and work out the extinguishment of slavery kind of fell by the wayside. Somebody asked me about that just a couple of days ago. Why did Jefferson go silent? And I said, hey, it would appear to me that had he not gone silent on the issue, he would likely never have been president. And so there's tremendous politics. There was all kinds of, and there was a, you know, it was a legal institution, and people actually had mortgages on slaves, right? And so you were in a big financial mess too to try and untangle it. So it was much more complex than people think.
Right.
But Jefferson, one of Jefferson's proposals, and this is in fact in the book, for the Constitution of Virginia, was that there would no further introduction into the state of Virginia of new slaves, and slavery would eventually become extinct
right.
As a result of no new slaves being introduced.
Would die with the slaves themselves.
And that was, in fact, his proposal for the Constitution of Virginia as far back as 1775.
Mm-hmm. So he's swiveling in his chair.
He's swiveling in his chair, right? Uh-huh. Yeah.
Let's bring it back. He's swiveling.
Just like I'm swiveling now. Man.
It's a great conversation to have, and I'm glad we got into that because it is fascinating to that the dichotomy between...
So as he swiveled, he wrote that line. Wait a minute, this chair was made, okay. And then, so we passed that line. So then the next line.
Interestingly enough, the way complaints, civil complaints and legal documents start in many ways, one of the ways a document in those days would start would be whereas, right? There would be a whereas, then you'd make several statements. Problem is that whereas was basically the beginning of a royal proclamation.
Okay.
And what these guys are doing is getting rid of the king.
Right.
Right?
So they got to change it up.
They can't say whereas. And he spent some time mulling this over. And that's when we come up with when in the course of human events, as opposed to whereas. So the opening line was something that he labored over quite a bit. Because, like I said, we wanted to change it up from the whereas that was a royal proclamation, because the rest of the document's going, we're getting rid of the king.
As he writes this document, and I imagine any writer, of course, takes ownership over what they write, I imagine as he presents it and he gives it to other people, they start to have some other opinions on words that could possibly change.
There were some. One of the most famous phrases, of course, is we hold these truths to be self-evident. And Jefferson originally wrote, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable, which just doesn't have quite the same panache.
The flow, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same flow as self-evident. Ben Franklin and John Adams were the only two of the rest of the committee that actually had any editing, Ben Franklin made only one change to the document, which is a pretty large compliment because Franklin was one of the premier writers and one of the prime editors and newspaper publishers of the day. And Franklin's change was from sacred and undeniable to self-evident.
Was he worried about the religious aspects of sacred and undeniable, or was it just the flow of it? That kind of screams like the pulpit a little bit.
It screams, I believe it was just the flow, because certainly he did not do anything about the law of nature and of nature's God.
True.
And the final paragraph where it talks to where they look to divine providence for guidance. There's more than a few religious references through the course of the rest of the document. So I doubt that Franklin's change had anything to do with religion. It had to do with the flow of the document.
What about Adams? Did he make any contribution, big changes to the document, or did he?
There's a few scratches here and there. Where Adams more or less wound up being the one defending the document in the Continental Congress when they ultimately presented the document on July the 1st. Then the Congress went to work on it. And ultimately, strangely enough, it took them about 3 days. They made 85 edits and got rid of about 25%
of the document.
About 25% of it was cut out, one of which had to do with a reference to slavery. And Jefferson's efforts to pin the international slave trade on the king and indicate that they wanted to abolish the international slave trade, but the king would not allow that to happen. And that got cut out by the Continental Congress, primarily at the urging of South Carolina and Georgia. Mm-hmm. South Carolina and Georgia did not want to go along with that element of it, and so that got cut out, and along with another 25%. And Jefferson ultimately said that they emasculated his work. Jefferson was largely silent during the course of those 3 days while they were working on it.
I give him credit because I could not sit there and let them touch anything I had written.
No, you can't.
Jefferson was really, really good with pen and paper. He was not known for giving speeches. He was not known for competitive arguing or debate. He was not. He is said to have had a fairly soft voice, low spoken. And so Adams was the one that actually defended the document during the course of the debates and the editing process over the 3 days from the 1st of July till the 4th of July.
I want to go to a quick commercial break, and then we got to talk about July 2nd,
yes,
3rd, and 4th, because there's some interesting things about the day we celebrate Independence Day, and maybe it's not the day we should be celebrating Independence Day. More with David Shatokas after this here on 720 WGN.
Say you should write it to your legal mind, and brilliance we defer.
Is that so?
Well, what is this, Curtis?
This is a suggestion of Rogers. This is from the musical 1776.
Oh, from the musical 1776 that Roger and I were talking about earlier. Very on the nose there. We just mentioned the Chicago Lakefront, Chicago Summer Blast. We did the live read. Why should we be celebrating Independence Day on July the 4th, David, in your opinion?
Well, not in John Adams' opinion.
Okay.
In John Adams' opinion, there was a course of things. Richard Henry Lee proposed independence June 7th. They put off a vote till July the 1st, and then they continued to debate a little bit more. And on July 2nd, they took a vote, and ultimately, on that day, a couple of interesting things happened on July the 2nd.
In Philadelphia,
in what we will now call Independence Hall, which was at the time also the Philadelphia State House.
Okay.
But a couple of interesting things happened that day. One of which is John Dickinson, who we related before that was tying up Pennsylvania, walked out of the time when they were voting. And while Dickinson walked out when they were voting on whether or not to vote for independence based on Lee's resolution, Ben Franklin cast the vote really quick for Pennsylvania.
Did he walk out on purpose? Was he morally object on his own sense that he didn't want to declare, he didn't want his name associated with it? Or did he just go to the bathroom or something?
right.
Like, that doesn't seem like a good time to go to the bathroom.
It was a bad idea if he was actually opposed to independence, but it really was kind of a walk in protest, but it seemed like everybody else was going to be going along. And so the vote turned out to be 12-0.
Missing one, aren't we?
We are missing one. New York.
Yeah.
New York. They abstained. New York abstained because it was very, very interesting. In those days, of course, these days we elect representatives, and representatives kind of go and vote what they think they should be voting.
Right.
But in the Congress in those days, the representatives actually got directions from home.
On what to do.
Gotcha.
And New York did not have direction on what to do on a vote for independence. And so New York abstained.
Wait, so legislators used to listen to the people who vote for them?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah, curious concept,
that's
right?
Crazy talk.
So on another day, we'll talk about the 17th Amendment.
Because there was back and forth. I mean, they wanted a unanimous vote, as the supporters of independence, as much as possible.
Right.
So an abstention was at least not a down vote, so they felt like that was an okay solution for everybody.
Well, that
maybe
allowed,
the only one they could do.
That allowed them, when they, at the heading of the Declaration of Independence, they were able to say the United States of America and Congress assembled issues this unanimous declaration.
Right, because it's 12-0.
Because it was 12-0.
So when this vote is happening, is it as dramatic as we see votes now? The health care bill vote last summer, so dramatic, where it's, is there someone, do they say the state's name? Do they go, what order, do you know what order they go in when they're casting the vote? Is it alphabetical? Is it north to south? Like, I'm just trying to put myself in that spin. Room, yeah. That moment.
During the break, you mentioned the musical 1776. Yeah. The musical 1776, although my major complaint with that is they make Richard Henry Lee look like a bit of a buffoon. But beyond that, it's pretty accurate in terms of representing how the vote goes for independence. It in fact did go by state in alphabetical order.
Okay.
And the other circumstance about that is, though, is by the time they did cast the votes, they knew that.
Yes.
The drama wasn't the same as it was in the movie, that they were kind of waiting for,
right.
They knew by the time the vote was counted that it was going to be the case.
So that's July 2nd.
That's July 2nd.
So why do we celebrate on the 4th?
And there's a famous letter from, you mentioned Abigail earlier, and one of the reasons we know so much about so many things is the correspondence between Abigail and John.
Adams.
John Adams. Abigail Adams and John Adams. And John wrote to Abigail on July the 2nd that July 2nd forevermore will be celebrated with fireworks and displays and parties and games across the country in commemoration of the birth of the nation. And Adams predicted July 2nd would forever be known. However, they didn't finish the editing work on Jefferson's document for another couple days, and ultimately a fellow by the name of John Dunlap published the Declaration of Independence and what they call the Dunlap broadsheets on the 4th of July.
So they had to edit a few more things that they had already voted on. This sounds like the precursor to when Nancy Pelosi says, we'll read it after we vote.
Right.
That sounds like the first original one of these things. That then, of course, the Democrats pointed at the Republicans at. Anyways, we can go back and forth. Right. So they've been doing this for a while then there.
They've been doing this for a while, yes.
So they print it on the broadsheets. And then what happens actually on the 4th of July?
On the 4th of July, they walk out and read it in the public square. They send a few. They send copies to all the capitals of all the states around the country, and even though New York had not cast a vote, New York eventually came around. But New York had not cast a vote at that particular time. They sent copies to General Washington. General Washington called together the troops. Read the declaration out loud to the troops, so they it got published in the newspapers all around the country, and spread the word. And it's kind of interesting because Jefferson had a task set out where he had to talk to a whole lot of audiences. Among them, he had to talk to the foreign powers, because the foreign powers certainly would not get involved if it was an internal British business. Mm-hmm. But it's not an internal British business when there's an independent country, so he had to make that presentation to them. He had to make a presentation to the American people at large to garner their support. But mostly, he had to, as much as anything else, he had to put together something that people would die for. He had to put together something that people would die for. And so the audience of General Washington's army, plus their potential recruits, was really, really important.
in creating, he had to speak to these various audiences, including the king, including the king and the British Parliament, and then the foreign governments. So the work that he did to do that was just incredible. What he crafted together to talk to all these audiences to motivate people to fight and die. You know, there's Article 6 of the Constitution makes everybody that holds a any kind of government position anywhere swear to take an oath to support the Constitution. Mm-hmm. But the fact is nobody takes an oath. Nobody goes out and dies so that the president can serve 4 years. Mm-hmm. So that the House of Representatives meets every 2 years, or tax bills originate in the House.
The words of the Constitution.
Yeah, right. So the Declaration is the inspiration, and the Constitution is the execution. Mm. Those I actually, because of I've been an elected official and admitted to practice law, so I've taken an oath 8 times to support the Constitution. That kind of drove me to try and understand what it was I was swearing to.
Right.
But the real thing that anybody swears to, the real thing that becomes the American creed, is 55 words. It starts with "We hold these truths to be self-evident," and ends up with "the consent of the governed." And what we should really, really memorize is not the preamble to the Constitution, mm-hmm. but the American Creed and the Declaration of Independence.
It's like you were watching the clock coming up to the end of this segment, David Shostokas. The book is Creating the Declaration of Independence. Where can people find it? Where can people get more information?
Amazon.com is Creating the Declaration of Independence. Follow me on Twitter at Shostokas, S-H-E-S-T-O-K-A-S. Take a look at my website, Shostokas.com.
And we're going to have you on soon because you got another new book. We can't tease too much about it, but you're excited about this next
one. I'm excited about this. I'll just say Shane Bouvet.
Okay.
If people Google Shane Bouvet, they can see B-O-U-V-E-T, Shane Bouvet, and...
From a founding father to Shane, actually, the first book you wrote, the book you wrote about independence, Shane met President Trump and has a relationship with him.
Their ongoing friendship.
And it's going to be a story about that. It's a fascinating what you told me and teased earlier and stuff. So we'll
might want to follow him on Twitter.
Yeah,
man.
I was just going to say.
Shostokas on Twitter.
You might get to see a retweet at some point soon by someone who uses Twitter pretty well. David, actually, you use Twitter a lot. You're great on Twitter. But one of the men you're writing about with President Trump and that relationship might be using Twitter even more than you do. So it'll be
more effectively at any rate.
John, can I ask a quick question? I know you got to break for news and get things going, but we played that little clip from 1776, and I've been listening to your guests talk about a lot of the processes, the history, the schedule of events of mm-hmm. how all this came about. And I don't know if he's seen the musical 1776, but it's all in there. All
right.
of these specific events that happen on these certain days, the communiques with General Washington in the field, the four of officials getting together to get the thing written and to even decide about what the national bird would be.
Right.
And things like that. And so I'm just wondering how accurate that presentation, if he has seen it, is.
Well, Roger's asking. You can't hear him because you don't have the headphones on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll relay the rest.
Okay.
He mentioned the musical 1776. You've seen it.
Yes.
How accurate, because Roger mentioned that a lot of these dates and things are covered, what the bird will be, what are these things. How accurate did you find that, as much as an American, or as much as a musical could cover it?
As much as a musical could cover it, it was... pretty darn accurate. Like I said, my major complaint was they made Richard Henry Lee into a buffoon.
Yes.
That whole, when he's riding on the horse, falls off the horse, and, you know, absolutely, and that whole thing. Richard Henry Lee was a serious guy with serious business.
All right. All right, Roger, hope that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you very
much.
All right,
okay, it is 4:30. Do we got a new sponsor here? So 4:32, we're a little late, Roger, but that was fascinating and really great stuff, and we're going to toss it over to you in the newsroom with the news.
Not
the Beatles.
Those circuses on the air.
The president doesn't.
Sometimes you feel like a.
That means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you
tear down this wall.
Here's Johnny.
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John's been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Thank
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in six seasons, it's one gone team, the Chicago Blackhawks, win the Stanley Cup. The Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
It's in time, and the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
Well, we've been talking about history for the last hour. Let's keep it going, Domati. What do you say?
Let's keep it going.
This has been awesome, and I know Dave Schwann, who joins us now in the newsroom. First of all, Dave, happy Sunday. How are you doing?
Hi, guys. Good morning. Happy Sunday to you.
Dave, I think that it was actually Plyer that I filled in for last year when we had Dave, and I don't know if you remember that conversation, or maybe it's just you and I have talked about the Founding Fathers. Don't know if you got to heard much about it, but I love this week because we have so much to look back on the formation of the country. That's a topic that interests you, I bet.
Yeah, a little bit.
Well, you seem to know a lot about it.
Well,
or is it just because Plyer's giving you the cliff notes?
No. I have been following American history for a long time, and I really got into it around college.
Okay.
I guess around the end of college when I first started working, and I was always keen on it. Having grown up in the 60s and seeing all of the turmoil and everything that went on, you know, at that time in our country and indeed the world, it just captured my attention.
Yeah.
And then when I got involved more into work and journalism, various places I've worked at, they let me do stories and feature stories on things like that. So I just fell into it.
Domati, are you a big history buff, Domati?
I am.
Yeah.
I am. Lately, I've been addicted. I was talking to you off air earlier about how addicted I've been to documentaries. And I've seen Hamilton, and that really got me really rethinking the way we really process these stories about the Founding Fathers.
Yeah.
All of these details that we wouldn't know.
Yeah, I just love the way that we're able to, you know, with the help of especially people like David, to kind of just, again, break down these people that we talk about in our history books and actually see them as real men and women.
Yes.
And get to know their, you know, deficiencies, their faults, their problems of the day, their preferences, their side habits, the other things that make them seem like real people. So,
and it comes full circle. Shawnee, earlier this morning, John and I were talking about just about living a life of purpose and what that would look like. And if you had 1 week to live, what would you do? What would you accomplish? And just coming back and talking about the Founding Fathers, finding out they put the pants on one leg at a time, just like us, swiveled in their chairs, just like we're doing right now.
I hear Dave Schwann puts his pants on two legs at a time. He just jumps in.
I just jump in the air.
Yeah.
And fall flat on my you-know-what.
All right, let's get into it.
This
is history, and we're going to start here. Of course, this is Sunday, July 1st. The Liberty Bell was rung to celebrate the first anniversary of independence, so it was rung on July 4th, 1777. Yeah, folklore leads us to believe that it was rung on Independence Day, but it did not happen that day, and Dave really apparently wants to dispel these crazy rumors. He wanted me to read that one, Schwann. It's marked clearly.
Right,
to read
up
this
at
one.
The top.
Yes,
too.
It is right there. You got the next one?
Yeah. So 1796, 20 years later, first Independence Day celebration was held. Now, in a remarkable coincidence, both John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, the only signers of the Declaration of Independence later to serve as presidents of the United States, died on the same day, July 4th, 1826.
How crazy is that?
Was first?
Adams was first.
Adams was first.
Is that in there?
Nope.
Oh, it was Jefferson.
Yep.
Was he in the afternoon then? Okay, so one died in the afternoon, one late at night.
Only hours apart.
Isn't that crazy?
Jefferson passed first, yeah.
Isn't that just insane that they die on July the 4th, the same July the 4th, exactly 50 years after signing the Declaration of Independence? I mean, it's just...
divine order. I'm trying to tell you guys something.
Really.
And then also I would point out that John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, served as president.
Yes.
And John Adams Sr. was still alive during that presidency.
Yep.
That's extraordinary when you think about that. Almost 200 years ago that people were living into their really late 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
That was extraordinary.
Well,
if you made it to 60, you were lucky then.
I think John and Abigail both lived to late 80s or early 90s. So that's pretty incredible stuff for them.
Well, check it out. It gets even weirder. So President James Monroe died on July 4th, 1831.
becoming the third president in a row who died on July 4th. Calvin Coolidge, the 30th president, was born on July 4th, 1872, and so far is the only president to have been born on Independence Day.
Well, so Monroe, so Adams, Jefferson, Monroe, so the second, the third, and the fifth president all dying on July the 4th. Okay, 1802, the U.S. Military Academy officially opened. That's West Point, and that's pretty cool stuff. There you go, West Point. Happy birthday, I guess you could say. 1819, first savings bank in the U.S., the Bank of Savings in New York City's opened up its doors. Cool. All right.
What else you got for us? 1831, America, my country, tis of thee, is first sung in Boston.
And then, my country, tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of the ice. Right, that's the one? Okay.
You like how I pretended to know the words just by saying the last thing she said? Yeah. Just kind of hummed along and, yep, told it myself.
What's your favorite, do you have a favorite patriotic song, Dave Schwann? I know there's like Yankee Doodle, there's all...
Actually, I do.
Oh, what is it?
And you may not think of it as a patriotic song, but I think of it very much so. It's Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land.
Ah, yeah.
Is it the descriptive nature that he goes into that gets it
That's
for you?
That's right. And then the last line in every chorus, this land was made for you and me.
That is a really sweet song. And it does, it describes the geographical features. It is one of those songs that when you hear it, does remind you that we are blessed to be in a country not only of democracy, not only of great wealth for many people, a lot of work left to be done, of course, but it is a land rich in, we got everything. Beaches, giant mountains, deserts. I mean, we are lucky to be in this vast land of so many cool different geographical features.
I know you want to move on here for just a second, to your point there, John and Domati, when Dad and I did our Route 66 trip together back in 2009, we met people from four foreign countries that came over here just to do Route 66 and drive it and to see the country. And having gone through Europe, we have a European Union and we have everything else. But those countries in the European Union are just that. They're countries. We have United States.
Yeah.
And they can't get over the size of the continent. And you really don't know how big this continent is until you get out there and drive it.
Dave, you're absolutely right. And Dave Schwann, not only that, I was at Lou Mitchell's Diner dressed as Thomas Jefferson the other day for a 4th of July show taping for the U. And I met a couple from Austria.
They were
at Lou Mitchell's Diner. They were starting their Route 66 journey.
They had
the book ready to go.
Yep.
They knew the song, and they were so excited. And I'm like, that's what you're doing? I've never even done Route 66. But that's what they were doing. And they said that was their first time in the country, and that people talk about it in Europe as taking Route 66 as the way to see the entirety, or at least most of it. You don't see much east of here, because this is where it starts. You've seen it.
One of the people we met, or a couple that we met, a newlywed couple, were from Sweden. They got married in Stockholm, Sweden, flew to New York City, had their honeymoon there, then came to Chicago, rented a huge Harley-Davidson motorcycle, and were driving all the way to California.
Wow.
That was their honeymoon.
I should do that. Do you want to do that after the show?
Let's do it.
You got about 6 days to kill?
Yeah.
We got 6 days left on Earth, apparently. Well,
that's it.
According to earlier.
So that's what we're doing the last week.
Route 66. Hopefully the gas station attendants will be there, or someone will at least keep it pumping. Okay. 1836, Wisconsin Territory forms. So maybe not at statehood, but as the Territory of Wisconsin formed. And I love Wisconsin. Going there next weekend for a little lake house visit. Going to eat some cheese and have some fun.
It was great until the Green Bay Packers formed.
I mean,
it was
it's been a while, Domati.
What else we got?
Let's see. 1863, General Lee's army withdraws from Gettysburg.
Of course, that famous battle. I think the second most deadly battle in the Civil War, a lot of people attribute it to be the most, but I think
Antietam was the single bloodiest day, and people really need to see both of those places.
They're
just unbelievable.
Well, Dave, I wonder, because I know people talk about it, is there just a hallowed experience when you step on those grounds? Is it something you feel when you're there? Or is it just a beautiful landscape in and of itself?
It's both, actually. It is beautiful landscape, both, especially Gettysburg, because that's such rolling country, Pennsylvania countryside. It's huge. I mean, where the battles took place were just absolutely huge. But will you ask if you feel it? I had the place all to myself. I stayed on the battlefield one night and got up at dawn and took pictures. And it was a clear
beautiful morning, and I had really the place almost all to myself.
Were you trespassing? That doesn't seem...
Technically, yes. But if you go on my Facebook page, I've got those posted up there.
Oh,
so
awesome.
Take the, you know, if you have a chance, go ahead and take a look at them.
That's awesome. We got to take a quick commercial break. We're going to wrap up This Is History and the Domati and John Show in for Dave Plyer after this on 720 WGN. An old recording there of This Land Is Your Land, The Sand Is My
Land. This land is
there it is.
Land.
We dusted off the original just for you, Swanee.
That is the original. Yeah.
Curtis had to go really quickly run back. He busted out the record player.
A 78 record player.
Yeah.
Cranked that up.
The joke is actually that the 78 record player is the only thing that works around here right now. So.
It came up so quickly.
Yeah,
it's from 1936.
Yeah, that's the one piece of equipment we got that's working here. No, everything actually been really smooth. And I got to say, really quickly, as we get back into this, love the Trip Tower. We'll miss it dearly. But, man, they did some incredible work.
Isn't
here
this great?
It oh, really is. Yeah. I know the listeners don't care as much as we do here. But if you ever get a chance to come see it, this is awesome stuff. Okay, so Domati, 1916, This Is History. Where are we going next?
This year marks the 100th anniversary of Navy Pier, commissioned in 1916 and part of the Burnham Plan. It was used for shipping and entertainment, but just a few years later, during World War I, the pier housed many Navy and Army personnel, the Red Cross, and home defense units. It even had a jail for draft dodgers.
Ooh, interesting. It looks like this is an old text that Dave forgot to update here. It's 100, so this would be the
102nd. It's
102
now.
Yeah, 102.
Absolutely.
He hasn't edited this for 2 years. Come on. Plyer, get on this thing. Just so everyone knows, Plyer, this is a great segment. I love doing this, Swanee. Every time Plyer, he always asks, oh, do you mind if we do? Of course I love doing it, but I love it because Dave produces the whole thing still, even though he's gone. He gives us the whole sheet.
All you have to do is show up.
I just got to show up and read the stuff that Plyer got for us. We're going to skip to 1964.
What's going on in 1964?
The number one song of this week in 1964, The Beach Boys. I get around. That's a great song. That song always makes me think of, I think it's Guess Who's Talking? What's that movie, one of the where the babies talk, and they are showing as one of the there's this scene, I know this is really gross, there's a sex scene to start one of these movies, and they show the visual of the, I don't know how to say this in radio terms.
I know.
The swimmers that...
The swimmers. You saw the swimmers. You saw the procreation happen.
And they play this song, if I'm not mistaken.
I know what you're talking about.
Anytime I hear this song, I can't stop.
Is it the movie with McLovin?
I don't
know. Was it Superbad?
No, I'm talking about, like, Look Who's Talking To or something like that. Yeah, where they had the babies do the talking and stuff.
Well, you're not the only one whose brain is out there, because when I saw I Get Around, the first thing I thought about was Tupac Shakur.
There you go.
That's I Get Around I know about.
Dave Schwann, are you a Beach Boys fan?
I am. Yes.
There you go.
They had a lot of great stuff out there.
Oh, yeah, for
Where
sure.
Where were you when this record came out, Swanee?
Let's see. 1964, I was, the summer of 64, I was in between second and third grade. So I guess I was just going to turn 8 years old.
Yeah, okay, all right. Getting around there at 8 years
getting
old.
Getting around at eight.
All right.
Really, okay.
Seven and a half, 8 years old.
All right, so this next one, Domati, you're going to give us, pertains to our jobs.
Oh, yes. 1978, the U.S. Supreme Court rules 5-4. FCC had a right to reprimand New York radio station for broadcasting George Carlin's filthy words.
Seven words.
Do you know them? Do you want to say them out loud?
No, not right now.
Let's hear a little bit of a clip.
There is absolutely nothing wrong with any of those words in and of themselves. They're only words. It's the context that counts. It's the user. It's the intention behind the words that makes them good or bad. The words are completely neutral. The words are innocent. I get tired of people talking about bad words and bad language. It's the context that makes them good or bad.
Yeah, it just makes me nervous even playing that
clip. I know.
Clip.
I was just ready to say, watch it.
I know.
Watch it.
Well, and I think that, you know, we always worry about that sort of stuff here in radio. And I think anytime I'm around a microphone, whether it's on, whether it's off, I always assume it's on. Did they teach you that in broadcast school, Dave?
Oh, yes.
Or just assume that the microphone is on because you never know what it is.
As a professor once said in class, this is kind of a good way to think about it. Act as though you were in church.
Oh, that's a good way to do it.
That's a good way to do it. Act as though you were in church.
So then I got to ask, without saying any of the words, Dave, have you ever said a curse word on the air?
I don't think so. I've said some maybe some vulgar slang.
You've offended millions, but you've never said a curse word.
And I did it unintentionally. I'll tell you the story sometime when we're off the air. It was a complete accident, a slip of the tongue.
Yeah, that's what they all say.
No, I have not. I have not gone it. Believe me, though, you do think about it.
Oh yeah,
I played a soundbite with profanity in it on accident at an old station.
Okay,
boy, but it was.
Did you get in trouble?
I did not, because it was breaking news. The host asked for it. I said, "We haven't vetted this. Keep your hand on the dump button."
Yeah,
timed it out right. And it went left.
Oh,
wow. We timed it out right, but it went left.
Yeah.
But that was the closest I've come, and never again shall I play audio that I've not previewed.
Yeah, you got to do that.
Good idea.
I've had people. One person I interviewed on the street. It was amazing. I interview people every morning on the street in the most random of circumstances. Going to work, I interrupt their day. Don't wait till you were out with me one day.
Yes.
Just putting random people on, and I've had one person drop the F bomb, and luckily we had the dump button ready to go. And I've almost said the S word. I thought I had said it, but I went back and watched and I said, shoot, when I thought that I wasn't on TV.
And you breathed a huge sigh of relief.
Yes. Oh. Well, I thought that I lost my connection to the studio, my IFB line, where they talk to you, where I hear the show.
See, that's where this comes in.
Yeah.
That's the situation and circumstances where this happens.
Right. Well, I lost it. I didn't know that we were on a commercial break. Our camera guy was still pointing at me, so the studio didn't know that I couldn't hear them. So they say, let's go out to John Hansen. I, meanwhile, had just heard silence for a while. I go, why don't I hear the studio? And I pull up my cell phone out of my pocket, and I saw that we had lost that call communication. I said, oh, shoot. Right when they were like, let's go out to John Hansen. And it's me looking at my cell phone going, oh, shoot. But I thought I had said something else. Oh, I was like, oh, man. Oh, but oh well. We all move on. Bigger and better
Four
things.
Four letters away from going viral there.
Right,
you just missed it.
Quick commercial break, then we'll wrap things up here on 720 WGN.